Hello, college football fans. Welcome to episode 164 of College Football Throwdown. I'm your co-host, Alex Schmitz, and today I'm joined, as always, by my dad, Peter Schmitz.
Hello, Husker fans and college football fans.
Hello, everybody. We are a father-son duo here to talk about college football by college football fans for college football fans. And today we'll be talking about our favorite team, the Nebraska Cornhuskers, the game against Wisconsin, our upcoming game against Iowa for our final regular season game, and then also the Nebraska volleyball team, who have a big match against Wisconsin this upcoming week. We're also going to talk about what's going on in the world of national college football, what's going on with Jim Harbaugh, and some of the coaching situations, plus the big games from this past week and what's coming up. Big Michigan-Ohio State game this week, so a lot to get excited about.
Exactly.
Yes. But before we dive into all that, we're going to stick with our tradition and crack open a cold beverage. I've got my Japanese Sapporo beer here.
Wow. You need to break out a little bit. You know, I try to change it up a little bit. Like, you know, I've been talking with you about Yingling. Now I have a Yingling Light, at least, right? So I'm going to open up that, you know, I'm trying to lose weight, be more svelte, you know, as we approach the holiday season. I'm feeling fat and I need to lose some weight, but this is going to help me. So that's why I'm drinking it.
All right. Well, cheers.
All right. Cheers. All right. Here we go, son.
And for the record, this is usually the only beer I have all week. So that's why it takes so long to get through a case.
Yep, I tried to corrupt you, and you're uncorruptible.
Well, you did take me to a casino that one time on a school board night.
Yeah, that I can never live down.
That's right. That's the classic. All right. So, of course, we'll be talking about the Wisconsin game. It was an away game for Nebraska. And we gave predictions on the previous podcast about the outcome. I predicted that we would win in a low scoring 17-13. Well, you predicted that we would lose 17-28. And then the final score ended up being a little closer to yours of 17-24. But it was a overtime game, went into this first overtime. And frankly, it was kind of another frustrating game for Nebraska fans, where we actually did exactly what I said on the previous podcast. I said we needed to get out to an early lead, and the early game went about as well as you could have asked for, in that we went up 14-0 and stopped Wisconsin from really doing much on offense. So at that point, you know, Chubba Purdy was starting as quarterback, even though you predicted last podcast that it would be Jeff Sims. They stuck with Chubba Purdy, and he was playing great, you know, got some big runs there in the early part of the game. And so it was looking like it was all going up for the Big Red. And then the offense, unfortunately, sputtered as the first half went on. You know, Wisconsin made some adjustments. We missed a critical field goal at the end of the first half, and it ended up coming down to be a nail biter like all of our games do. So, yeah, it was another one of those.
Exactly. Yep. And, you know, there's all kinds of points within the game where you could say, well, if we had made this decision or if we had executed on this play or this thing, then, you know, the outcome would have been different. And when you're playing with football and it's a game of inches because you don't have the talent or the, you know, consistency of coaching and just all your internal structures so that you can have that natural advantage, then, you know, the little things really expose your weakness.
Right. And when you look at the stats, both teams had 19 first downs. We actually had a bit more total offense, 364-316 for Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We did something that was critical that we mentioned last podcast, which was to avoid turnovers. There was only one turnover at the very end of the game on the last play on a fourth down, which, you know, at that point, the game's already over. So I don't.
That was disappointing. Obviously, you would have loved to have had some great play there, but the bottom line is that was an inconsequential turnover as turnovers go.
Right. So we succeeded in that. We didn't turn the ball over. Chubba Purdy, yep, despite his previous injury, made it through the whole game without getting injured and having to step out of the game. One place where we unfortunately regressed is that we had 7 penalties for 54 yards, while Wisconsin had 4 for 45 yards. Whereas in the previous two games, we had been very low on penalties. This one, we had quite a few false starts. And maybe you can attribute that somewhat to Chuba not being used to being the quarterback, right?
Right.
And of course, you know, that Wisconsin Stadium got loud in the second half once it became a really close game. You know, we kind of took them out of it, the crowd out of it early, but we weren't able to keep that momentum going.
Right, right. That's huge, right? When you've got a team down like we did early in that game, I mean, you couldn't have asked for a better start for Chuba and for our team. We had a drive, which ultimately ended in a fourth down attempt that was unsuccessful. But if we get that fourth down conversion and continue that drive and end up scoring points, right, and go up 21-0, then the whole game might very well have played differently.
Right. Or even just getting a field goal there, you know, with how low scoring the game turned out to be, that would have been nice because that was the third possession of the game. So, yeah, we would have been able to kind of continue that momentum. And, of course, we had a bit of a discussion about special teams on the previous podcast, and I was here defending Tristan Alvano. And then, of course, he has to let me down and miss a 42-yard field goal at the end of the first half, which, as it turns out, if we had had that field goal, then when we were driving at the very end of the game, we would have been driving to tie the game. We would have been driving to get a win with a field goal. And thankfully, he did clutch up and make a 30-yard field goal at the end of the game that got us into overtime. But, you know, you just, you know, that's one of those things, right? Like you're mentioning, the plays that could have gone differently and made a huge difference. That's definitely one of them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's frustrating because I think again, there were periods of the game where we had enough success to suggest that we should have won the football game, right? But you know, the underlying thing that bothered me throughout the game was once about the first quarter was over, I felt like Wisconsin at that point had made some adjustments. Like you said, initially we were doing some things up front that maybe they weren't ready for or they weren't executing properly. And so we were having great success. I mean, we were averaging, you know, probably 8 yards a carry or maybe even more than that because, you know, of course the quarterback had a huge run. But I mean, we were just chunk play after chunk play after chunk play and mostly on the ground. And so, you know, that was wonderful, but that didn't sustain. They made some adjustments and all of a sudden we didn't have that room to run, at least not to get those chunk yards. But again, you have to stay with it and say, okay, well, they've adjusted to this. There should be something else in your arsenal that gives you the ability to, address that and say, okay, because they took this away. Now we got to go to this. Right. But we didn't, successfully have that second wave of success that we needed to have.
Right.
And that's where our offensive system is just not mature enough, you know, because of players and coaches. The system just is not ingrained enough yet that we have that.
Right. All right. Well, and when you look at Purdy's stats, he was 15 of 23 throwing it for 169 yards. And he also ran it for 105 yards on 14 carries. So, you know, he performed well overall.
Very well.
And in terms of our plays, we had 40 rushing plays and 23 passing plays. So pretty similar to what we've seen, right? About 2/3 running it. But like you say, you know, sometimes it's just the timing of when Satterfield, our offensive coordinator, chooses to call that pass play, you know, and then we try to go for something big and we miss and now we're in a, you know, third and long situation.
Coach Rhule went into halftime. You know, we had just, like you said, we had just missed that opportunity to kick a field goal and go up. And we, you know, I know there's lots of talk about clock management and on the boards and stuff like that and in the analysis of the game. And you can certainly be critical of Coach Rhule's decisions on clock management. but it's really not about his clock management per se, as much as it was that it was he obviously had made the choice that he was going to play conservative, and he didn't want the other team to get the ball again. So he was content to go for the field goal, or to basically lay up and not be aggressive, because he had been so roundly criticized for being overly aggressive the previous week. Now, I would argue that the circumstances of what was going on in the Wisconsin game and the circumstances of the previous week were night and day different, and he shouldn't have referenced that to influence his decision making and the circumstance he was in. But he did there at the end of the first half, and then at the beginning of the second half, if I've got this right, our first six plays, 5 passes and 1 run. And that's during the first 6 minutes of the first half or the second half, which Coach Rhule acknowledges are critical to a game, right? He talks about the first 6 minutes of the second half being very important. And they coach that, and they create drills around that concept of how important it is that you come out after halftime and have success in those first 6 minutes after half, right? The adjustments, if you will.
Right.
And we threw it 5 of the first 6 plays.
Right. And it felt to me like, because Chuba actually made some really nice passes early on in the game, but felt like later on he was overthrowing his guys a lot or going too high. Which obviously that's a problem when you're going for these pass plays. The whole second half, I mean, the offense really struggled to get anything going, and Wisconsin was just slowly kind of crawling back there. Our defense played well overall. We 3-and-outed them several times. We got 2 sacks, stopped them on 2 fourth downs, So, while you can be critical of some of the big plays they gave up, and some of our struggles on our defensive line, overall, they held them to less points in regulation than you predicted in your previous score.
Right.
But the offense just couldn't get a drive going, until, of course, late in the game. And then we finally got something going, but then we were running into the clock problem.
Right, exactly. Well, and again, those were coaching decisions. Coach Rhule chose to not call those timeouts. We had 3 timeouts. We had all the time in the world, man. Time should have never been an issue for us on that drive. But he chose to let it play out and allowed, literally, minutes go off the clock. So it was all I can conclude is he wanted to play it conservative and go ahead and get down into field goal range and kick a field goal to tie it. And he was interested in going into overtime. Now, again, so if I can just quickly jump to last week and compare and contrast those two circumstances, right? Last week we were in a tie ball game. We weren't having to score points just to get to the tie, right? We were in a tie ball game when we threw that pick, right? And last week we were at home,
right?
And so you behave differently. The typical book on what you do in certain situations as coaches is the standard 99% or 98% of the time. This is what coaches do: is if you're at home, you go for the tie and for overtime because you're at home and you believe in your crowd, you believe in your team's ability and the comfort level they have in their home stadium. Maybe you go that route. Now, there can still be game circumstances that might influence that, but that's the standard book thing to do, is to go for the win when you're away, go for the tie and settle for overtime if you're at home. Right.
Right.
And Coach Rhule did the opposite of that, which just doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Well, so now I'll be the Rhule defender here, because we were texting about this, after the game and everything. Because I saw in his press conference today, we're recording this on a Monday, he basically said, I think it was the right decision. I probably should have called the timeout at 30 seconds instead of 20 seconds. He did say that, but he said, I thought our defense deserved to have the game go into overtime, you know, and get the chance to play more and to prove themselves in this situation. And you obviously want to avoid what happened last week with Chuba throwing a pick, sure. You know,
yep.
And just losing the game entirely, right? And you would be criticized in the same way that we were in the previous week. And you want to run out the clock so that Wisconsin doesn't have time to try a drive of their own, right? If you score a touchdown, say, but you leave, you know, a full minute on the clock, you know, Wisconsin has enough passing ability that they could, you know,
sure.
Go for something crazy.
But you just said you're going to rely on your defense. You're going to trust your defense in overtime. Why wouldn't you trust them in the last minute or minute right. And a half of the game if you ended up with a minute and a half on the clock because you scored too quickly,
right?
Which is that's a bullshit argument, right?
That's true, but you know there's a big difference between having to defend 80 yards and having to defend, you know, 25 yards, right? And in how it actually played out in the game, our defense forced Wisconsin into two third and long situations where, frankly, they yep. should have been able to stop them and force Wisconsin to kick the field goal. And if that had happened, then the momentum when we get the ball on offense in overtime is totally different. And we have the yes. opportunity to go for the win aggressively, you know, with the touchdown. Yep. And if we don't get it, we can fall back on the field goal and go into second overtime, right? So
I totally agree with all that.
I'm not saying it was the best decision, but it's a totally right. reasonable and defensible position. Yes.
I agree with you. And that's why I say the people who are saying the clock management was poor are attacking the wrong issue. If you want to be argumentative about Coach Rule's decision, it's his choice to let the clock run out, right, in that previous drive, rather than because my argument would be, you know, we made some mistakes on that drive that ultimately thwarted it from getting closer and putting ourselves in a better position to have time and maybe a couple of extra plays to go because we kicked the field goal and it wasn't fourth down, right? So we could have just managed that whole thing differently if we had used our timeouts, because we lose those timeouts at the end of the half. So you don't carry those over in overtime. So why not use them so that you can talk with your team instead of them having the rush? And they were in this frenetic rush mode, and they made some mistakes. There was confusion. You could tell communication wasn't where it was. You've got a brand new quarterback, his first game, you know, as the starter. I mean, all the damn timeouts, you had them, right? So that's my argument there. And here's the other fundamental thing. And maybe Coach didn't see this. Maybe he didn't understand this. But we were never able to stop them, especially in the second half, unless we blitzed and guessed right. Our ability to just line up and play mano a mano defense with their offensive line couldn't do it. They were dominating us at the line of scrimmage. And the only times that you're right, we did have some plays where we stopped them, you know, cold on a fourth down or whatever, on a critical third down. And we did do that on a few occasions. And on almost every one of those occasions, if you go back and watch the tape, it's because we had a blitz package or we had some kind of a guess going on. The reason that they were having so much success on third down is because Coach White, and again, I'm not being overly critical of him because that's what the 3-3-5 is. We were constantly looking and at least looking like we were going to blitz. And then sometimes we were backing off. Well, then our linebackers wouldn't get to their proper depths because they would back off too late, and which opened up the middle of the field. And many of those darn third down conversions that they got were in the middle of the field, catches just beyond the sticks or just before the sticks, and then where they were able to run for the first downs because we had linebackers who were not in their proper depths on their coverage.
Right.
And that's because they were faking a blitz.
Or their quarterback Mordecai would just tuck it and run it.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
They beat us with that several times.
Mm-hmm. So my point is if he did was his presumption was his defense was going to be able to stop them, their running back, once they got into the fourth quarter and they knew they had the big hoss, I mean, none of us, we had guys throwing their bodies at that damn Allen. Okay. He's a beast. I mean, you just look at him on TV and he's a monster compared to any running back we've got. Right. The guy is a muscle bound power back. And when he would run the football, the best we could do is keep him to 3 yards. And in most cases, he would carry us to a 5 yard carry. Right. And now we had a bunch of guys there and we would gang tackle him eventually, but that's not a way that does not bode well for fourth quarter circumstances where they have four downs to advance the ball. Right. If they needed to.
I want to say, I think in the first half, we held him to just like 8 yards. Like he barely anything.
Well, exactly. And he was kind of dinged up and he was going in and out of the game, but then he got a second win in the second half and they were dominating us in the third and fourth quarter. And we couldn't do anything. Hell, we were going backwards on almost every offensive possession.
I don't agree with that. I'm looking right now. He had 22 carries for 62 yards. So he was averaging about 3 yards a carry. And from my perspective, he was clutch for them when it was third and short or third and three or something like that. Yeah. They would bring him in and he would get them the third down. He wasn't getting big yards, but he was getting them those short yard situations.
Exactly, because their offensive line was dominating our three-man defensive front, and we were trying to blitz with these tiny linebackers, which ultimately caused our linebackers to get banged up during the course of the game because they were just getting beat up by that big offensive line. And if you look at his per carry, his individual carries, and you look at the ones in the fourth quarter, I guarantee you they were way more than the average earlier. Earlier in the game, we were tackling that guy behind the line of scrimmage. He had negative plays. So the whole thing switched, man. And once you realize that as a coach, you need to understand, hey, you know what? They're physically beating us at the line of scrimmage. So we've got to change some things. And Coach White did a great job. I mean, his system, you know, gives the flexibility that he can attack and he can get you down a variety of ways. He can blitz people around the sides, around the corners, and get tackle you at the legs and things like that. But then when it gets down to third down, now you got a problem, okay? Because if the guy's just going to line up and they're going to bring in an extra tight end or who's basically an extra lineman and just bull rush you, they did that. You know, when they scored their touchdown, there was one of them where they literally just their lineman just pushed the player in from the 5 yard line.
Right.
Do you remember that play?
Oh yeah.
When they scored. Yeah.
Right. Well, that's what I wanted us to do on our fourth and one was just do the tush push, and we did.
Right. Yep. Exactly. But that's because we don't have an offensive line capable of that against a good defensive front like Wisconsin had. So. It's about us just not having the horses and their offensive line. My God, when that guy went back to pass, he had all day. If we weren't blitzing, our down linemen were unable to get even a little bit of pressure on Mordecai.
Yep.
I mean, we just weren't.
But so right now I'm looking at the play-by-play on ESPN. So Wisconsin had five drives in regulation in the second half. And yep. Only one of those led to points, which was one touchdown drive. All the rest were either a punt or we stopped them on downs. So you can't be too mad at that result, right? You kept them to 7 points in the second half.
I'm not mad at the result of the defense. What I'm mad at is that our coaches didn't realize, and it should have been, you know, the line coach, obviously, and maybe some of the assistants that might be up in the booth being able to say, hey, guys, they're changing the line of scrimmage on us. You know, we are not controlling this line of scrimmage. And you need to know that as you make your play calls defensively and as you make your decisions as a head coach in critical moments. You need to know that. And it seemed like Coach Rhule was not operating with that as a presumption of information, right? He obviously didn't get that information and did not see it himself.
Right.
And I'm telling you as a guy who watched the game live, it was obvious to me we were getting pushed around.
Yeah.
When it mattered, in those critical third downs, those critical plays, when they were trying to sustain drives and, you know, keep us from getting more offensive possessions, et cetera. But again, not to belabor this anymore, but the bottom line is there's so many things I love about what's happening at Nebraska and what Coach Rhule is doing, but we're still making enough of the wrong decisions in game. And then our players are making enough mistakes, illegal procedures, things of that nature, that it's leading to us losing football games.
Yep, but you know, we were competitive away against Wisconsin. Unfortunately, yep. In that overtime, we had two big players go out with injury. Anthony Grant, our running back, went out, and then Heinrich, our defensive linebacker, also went out. So that was a bit of a bummer, you know, that you get an overtime and you lose two big players like that. I did not see any confirmations about the extent of their injuries, but my expectation would be we will not see either of them in the Iowa game next week.
Right. Especially since it's such a short week, right? We're playing on Friday and we played an evening game on Saturday night. So that makes it even harder. Really, you literally are a day and a half shorter week.
Yes. Speaking of which, we are playing Iowa. This is a home game for us. And I will be coming into the game as the Big Ten West champion. They're already basically guaranteed for that. And they'll probably be a top 15 team in the country in the rankings. The playoff rankings have not come out yet as we record this on Monday. But they played at home for them against Illinois this past week and won in a very Iowa score of 15-13. It was a very defensive game, lots of field goals. And actually, Iowa was down. It was 13-9
yep.
Up until the last 5 minutes of the game, basically, where they got a big play, which led to a touchdown.
Yep.
Which Iowa's had a lot of those, right? A lot of narrow wins, you know, low scoring wins. So, you know, we've done well against Iowa in the past, either where we won against them or we would come close to winning, you know, even in years where they were considered quite a bit better than us. So I'm very worried about our offense, you know, going up against that very good defense, right? The clear strength of Iowa's team is their defense and then their kicking game, right? In a punting battle, they definitely beat us in that regard.
Oh, God.
So, you know, if it becomes a field position war, right, and they get a safety on us, you know, I can see that going badly. But on the other hand, their offense is not good. Their offensive coordinator is being let go at the end of this year, after all. And our defense is the strength of our team. So it's going to be a defensive battle. And actually, the bookies have given it to us as a 1.5 favorite over Iowa.
Can you believe that? I mean, if that doesn't speak volumes to this whole situation, right? Even the bookies, even the Vegas odds makers and all the algorithms that they have suggest to them that Nebraska should be a favorite at home. Now, typically, a home field is worth 3 points. So, effectively, on a neutral field, that would suggest it would be Iowa plus 1.5 instead of us being the favorite. But the fact that a team that is 5-6 and is on a 3-game losing streak is the favorite over a 9-2 top 15 ranked Iowa team who's already secured the Big Ten West and will be playing for the conference championship. What does that say, right?
Well, it says the Big Ten West is terrible this year, which is true.
Well, that's true. But how can the winner, who is 9-2, go into a game against a 5-6 team that has found an ungodly number of ways to lose winnable games? How could Vegas arrive at that conclusion, right? That just, I find that amazing.
Apparently they opened as a 1-point favorite and it has now switched to us being 1.5 favorites. So enough people are betting for us. Clearly some people like our chances. You know, it will be a home game. It's senior day, right? So while it is an early morning game, which isn't great for crowd excitement, you know, I think the fans will be into it. This is our last chance, obviously, to get to the 6 wins, right? Which we've talked about plenty on earlier episodes. Though I was going to say, we still have a chance to make it to a bowl game at 5-7, right? One of the lesser ones.
But I, you know what? I wouldn't count on that. There's a bunch of things that would have to line up for that to happen. And that will taste bitter, right? To
a
Nebraska fan. But we should do it if we get the opportunity, because we need the practice.
Well, of course we'll do.
So that would be great.
Yeah.
We'll cross the bridge, but when we have to, but I actually, here's the thing. The thing I wish I didn't do enough prep before this on this particular subject of Iowa's offensive line. I really don't know how they've performed this year, and coming into this game, how healthy are they, and how, you know, now I will tell you, in that last drive where they scored the touchdown, their running back got a huge hole, right, to run through. You could have ran a truck through it. So I don't know if their offensive line is coming together right at the right time here at the end of the year, or whether that was just dumb luck one play, right? But bottom line is, if our defensive line can be effective enough that we can get pressure on them with our standard three front guys and one blitzer, right? So four people being allocated to the rush, then we have a chance against this team. But if we have to blitz like we were against Wisconsin, where we had to do a house call basically to get any pressure on the quarterback, then it's going to be a tough day for us. Right. I think that's the key to the game, because I'm basing that on the fact that I'm hopeful that we now have a quarterback who is going to be able to manage the turnover situation, and the rest of the team is going to do what they're supposed to do. Athletically, our wide receiver group and our tight ends are every bit as good as their tight ends. Now, they use their tight ends really well at Iowa, and I love some of the schemes that they run. Very high school-esque, but very effective at just consistently moving the ball, right? Getting those first downs and keeping possession and making the game short. What I'm most concerned about is our punter.
You didn't have a great game against Wisconsin.
Well, yeah. He's had fewer great games, or even good games, than he has had games where he hurt us. And that's a problem.
Right. Yes, right. Well, and like you said, they've got a great punter. So, you know, we have to concede that we're not going to win in a, you know, war of a field position.
Right. Which is what they play every week.
Right. But, you know, we've got the opportunity to potentially get some big plays, right? Chuba proved that he could do that here against Wisconsin. And I'm looking right now, Iowa got 114 yards rushing on 36 attempts, averaging 3.2 rushing yards per attempt. So nothing crazy, right? You know, solid.
That does not suggest their offensive line is excellent.
Exactly, right? And probably think about how many of those yards came on that last big play, right? So
yeah, exactly.
So yeah, I think, you know, despite the fact that they've got way more wins than us, you know, I think it is a doable game, and I'm ever the optimist here on this podcast. So I'm going to go ahead and say that we manage to win in a low scoring affair against Iowa, and come out on top at home and get our sixth win in our last game of the year. You know, it would, it's kind of frustrating, you know, that we went on this 3-game losing streak. But if we can manage to cap off the season with a win against, you know, the Big Ten West champion, I think Nebraska fans would feel pretty good about that.
Oh, Alex, if we won this game, and go to, not only do we get the six wins, but we get to give Iowa another loss at the end of the year that puts a sour note in their season when they are the Big Ten West champs. I think it would be fabulous. It would be a wonderful, wonderful way for us to finish the year. Okay. And here's the thing. I agree. I think our offense is capable of putting up some points against this very, very staunch Iowa defense. Keeping in mind that there is a player who was an All-American for them, who's probably going to be an All-American special teams guy, punt returner, and a surefire top three-round pick as a defensive back, maybe top two-round defensive back pick, who hurt himself and is out for the game. And so without that guy, they did well with him, without him last week because he got hurt the previous week, and they still won. They beat Illinois. But I think not having him at the punt return spot hurts them, and maybe we're able to get a matchup with some of our young talent at wide receiver and tight end that allows us to have some success moving the football. And if we can do that, I think we can win it too.
All right.
So well, I want us to win it. I'm so desperate for us to get to the sixth win. I'm going to predict and manifest. I'm going to manifest that Nebraska gets the six wins. And I'm going to say that the way that I don't think we win a close game. I think they win if it's close. So I think we have to, win like 28 to 12.
Okay.
They're going to get a safety on us, and then they're going to score a field goal and a touchdown. So that's their 12, and we're going to score four times. Okay. 28 to 12.
I like it. And I'm going to go a little bit lower scoring. I'm going to say we win 20 to 13. In a slightly lower scoring affair. But I'm in agreement with you. You know, I definitely think it's doable. And like I say, we've had kind of surprising success against Iowa in past years, even under Scott Frost, right? When Iowa would come into this game, you know, looking like the much better team in terms of record and everything, we've usually given them trouble. So I think it's doable. And I hope that Chubba Purdy, you know, keeps the composure he had in this. You know, this was his first game of the whole season, you know, of his whole time in Nebraska being the starter at the beginning of the game, right? And he did a pretty good job. So if he can build on the momentum, you know, work on some of those throws that he missed in the Wisconsin game, I think we can pull it out.
Yep. Yeah. And there's still some potential there for us to do quite well. Now, and that would just be a great launching pad for us to go into our, you know, our bowl season and the off season in general, to be able to win this sixth game this Friday, and then, you know, get a moderate bowl and maybe go win it, you know, and then be 7-6. Hey, that builds huge momentum for next year.
Yes.
So I want this so badly for all of these seniors who have been through hell in their time at Nebraska. And it'd be awesome.
Yes, I agree. And one other important thing that Matt Rhule talked about in his press conference today was that a coaching firm apparently contacted him, asking him about Tony White and about his, you know, abilities or potential to be a head coach. And Rhule was very complimentary of Tony, saying that he would make a great head coach, you know, and some Nebraska fans have, you know, heard that and thrown up their hands and be like, oh God, Tony White's leaving, you know, this right. is the end. And you know, it's not that right. You know, of course, Rhule is going to, you know, compliment his friend and his coaching partner, and who has done a great job this year. So I think, you know, Nebraska, to me, it's kind of like a coin flip at this point, right? If Tony White stays and we give him a raise, you know, and he's able to build on the success next year, great. That's what I want. But I think it's equally as likely that he leaves for some sort of other position in the offseason.
Right. He has no loyalty to the University of Nebraska, or he doesn't need to, right? He's only been here for one season. But I think based on his commentary, he's had a very positive experience in Lincoln. He just moved his family 1 year ago from Syracuse, New York to Nebraska, to Lincoln. And so his kids have gone through that transition. But ironically, the two jobs that would be most likely for him to get a good head coaching opportunity at happen to both be open. San Diego State, where he coached for many years in San Diego, he cut his chops there, and he learned his 3-3-5 defensive philosophy there in San Diego, and then he implemented it at Syracuse, and both of those institutions have fired their head coaches. So either one of those places, it would be logical that he would be a candidate, right? So I think that's what's going to happen, is they're going to offer him. But again, if you're Syracuse of the ACC, how much can you offer a first-time head coach who's, you know, defensive coordinator that you're recruiting to be the head coach? And I would think you might be looking to see if you could find somebody who's got head coaching experience first, and that, you know, Tony would be down the rung a little bit, you know, if some other people say no first.
Right.
So I don't know that he's the leading candidate for that Syracuse job. And then San Diego, I mean, there, you're taking a huge step down into a smaller division. And Coach Rule's comments included the fact that, hey, you know, his advice to Tony was, don't just take any head coaching job. Make sure it's the right opportunity. And that means somebody who's going to have the resources to compete and where you can build a successful program. Don't just take a head coaching job to be a head coach, because frankly, the money he would make in San Diego isn't going to be that much more than he's likely going to get paid by us over the next 2 or 3 years. Right. And if he continues to have the success he had this year, next year, he'll get some real opportunities next year.
Yeah.
So I'm hopeful he's smart enough to recognize that next year's the opportunity window for him, not this year.
I would agree, though I will say if Syracuse did offer him, I think he would take it, because that's a significant step up from San Diego State in terms of opportunity and prestige and everything.
I would agree. And he's been there before, and his family just moved from there. So if his family had a positive experience there, the kids liked school there, all that kind of stuff, then in all likelihood, he's going to do that, right? Like, that would make sense.
So now we're going to transition into a different Nebraska team that's having more success than the football team, which is, of course, the women's volleyball team. In fact, they clinched the Big Ten championship, the Big Ten title, this year. Or I'm sorry, not this year, but this past week, because of their wins and other teams' losses. And we had previewed how that Michigan game was a very important one for the team, and how coach would have a whole week basically to prepare them for that game and kind of reinforce some of the basics that maybe we've been slipping on recently. And we performed very well against Michigan. It was a 3-0, and I know some of the sets were very dominant, like 25-15 type scores. So we controlled well against Michigan, and against Iowa, it was also a 3-0. I know we slipped up a little bit more there. There were some closer sets, but we hung on that one. And meanwhile, in these past few weeks, Wisconsin, who, of course, we beat in the big match, legendary five-set match a few weeks ago, they've since lost to Purdue and to Penn State. So now they have 3 losses on their record going into our rematch this Friday, which is at Wisconsin, which is the big match that, of course, the whole volleyball world will be watching. But what's your assessment of the girls going into this? Do you think they improved enough from what you were discussing last time?
To win in Wisconsin, you mean?
Well, let's start with just did they take the steps forward you wanted to see?
Oh, no, they didn't.
Even though they dominated Michigan pretty well.
Well, they did. They looked quite good against Michigan, but again, there were still these moments of lapse, right? Like, things were just seemed a little bit off at times, even though offensively they had a great match. They hit for like 368 hitting percentage kill percentage. So, you know, the stats looked good, but our defense seemed a little off, especially our block has not been good for a few matches now. So there's definitely some stuff that we seem a little out of kilter. Our setter, as good as she is, seems like she's putting some more balls in spots that aren't as ideal for our hitters as she used to, but she's doing a great job of feeding the middles now. She was struggling with that earlier. They worked on that, obviously, and it is dramatically improved, but at the cost of, I think, being off a little bit more on her sets, the outside hitters, and them having to tip and roll shot more than they were earlier in the year. So I'm hopeful that that can all get cleaned up, you know, over the course of this week now, before we have to go to Wisconsin. And then the Iowa game, I'm going to just write that off as a team that was, you know, they were playing a team that was expected to lose to them. They were in an environment where, you know, more than 50% of the crowd was Nebraska fans, even though it was an away game. And we had already, you know, won a share of the championship, but they knew the pressure was on for them to close it out so that they could be the exclusive solo champions of the Big Ten. And they got that done, and it was 3-0. And the second half of the third set, they actually played Nebraska volleyball. The first two and a half sets, not so much. Right. Again, mostly because the blocking wasn't there. The digs, the back row defense was off the charts good. Lexi Rodriguez was playing out of her mind, and she always plays great, but she was particularly great in that Iowa match. So, they're going to rise to the occasion, I think, going into this Wisconsin game. Now, we don't have anything to play for on paper. We've already won the championship for the conference. We've secured enough of a record that we're going to be a top four finisher, and we're going to get home field, so to speak, advantage for the first two weekends of the tournament. So there's six games in the tournament, right? If you get all the way to the final championship game in volleyball, well, for four of those six games, we're going to be playing at home at the Devaney Center. So that's huge. And that's probably true whether we lose our last two or not. So the only thing that Nebraska is playing for is just dogged pride, you know, because there's some goals out there that they can achieve if they're able to win these games. And also to make sure that if you get that number one, you know, position, then your matchups might be slightly better for you in your bracket, right? That's the idea. You would expect the number one seed bracket to be better than the number two seed, better than the three seed. Right. So those are the reasons to be incentivized to play well. But I don't think any of that is enough versus the motivation that Wisconsin, if Wisconsin loses to us, there's a chance they might fall out of the top four and they would end up having to go play somewhere else for the second weekend. They would only get two games at home, and then their third and fourth match would end up somewhere else, right? So, and they're going to have a rabid, as you saw last weekend with the Wisconsin football game, Wisconsin fans are, they're mean, right? They're just flat out mean. I'm serious. They're not a bunch of blue hair, quiet, you know, respectful people like Nebraska tends to have way too many of, right? Their college students are way more aggressive than ours are. And their general fan base is way more aggressive. And so the environment that these girls are going into is going to be very much like it was when we played Penn State out at Penn State. So, So it's going to be an interesting deal.
And you explained to me that when Wisconsin suffered those two losses, they were without one of their best players who was going through a concussion protocol, and she is back and played in their recent 3-0 win. I believe it was over Indiana going into this game. Of course, we have to contend with one of their best weapons on the team. So
exactly.
My prediction real quick here is going to be that we lose because our victory against them was very narrow and very gritty, right? And that was at home for us, and they'll have the home field advantage this time. So I think we're going to lose. But I'm going to be bold here and say that we do bring it to five sets, that we make it a close game. It's going to be another really fun one to watch, but this time we can't pull it out.
Right. I'm hopeful that we get one. I think a 3-1 loss is what I would hope to get accomplished. And more importantly, what I want to see is that after we lose, that'll be our first loss, that we don't go in the tank and lose the following night. Because, you know, Wisconsin is only one of the two games we have this week. We have to play a Minnesota team the very next night. That is probably coming off its most complete and dominant performance of the entire season. they're a team that going into the season was a consensus top 10 team, and they're not even in the top 25 now. And they have really struggled to find themselves. They've really struggled to play well this year and have underachieved in many ways from a record standpoint. Now they're still going to be in the tournament, but just kind of barely, right? So I worry more about us letting the Wisconsin loss that happens on Friday beat us twice. And we end up, you know, in a psychological position and mental state that allows Minnesota to basically, you know, blood in the water, and they attack us and get us when we're down. So what I don't want to see is us lose two matches this weekend. But it would take a Herculean and just enormously tough-minded a result for us to beat the very mature Wisconsin team at Madison, given the circumstances that surround the match. It's just not as important now because we've already won the Big Ten championship. We're going to be the Big Ten champions this year no matter what. And we're into the tournament, and we're pretty much guaranteed, even if we lose both, of one of the top four seeds.
Right. True, but because Wisconsin has had such a stranglehold on Nebraska volleyball over a long time now, I think any win against Wisconsin, no matter its placement in the season, is meaningful.
Yep.
And I think the girls will, like you say, I think they will step up. I think John Cook, you know, will use these days, you know, leading up to Friday to get them hyped up and prepared and focused. So that's what I hope to see this weekend.
Me too. And if we win, if we beat Wisconsin on Friday, that's going to scream volumes to me about our potential to win the national championship. Right now, I think we're a team that's probably going to underachieve in the tournament because we're just so damn young. But if we can show a grittiness in this match in that environment, then that will prompt me to change my opinion of where the ultimate end of this team is going to be.
All right.
For this season.
So now switching over to college football, one big piece of news from this past week was that Jim Harbaugh and the Big Ten reached an agreement. You know, there was talk of this, legal action that
lawsuit,
Michigan was taking because of his 3-game suspension by the Big Ten. But basically, they've settled and come to agreement that Harbaugh is going to sit out for all three of the Michigan games, which two of which have already come and gone now, with the big one against Ohio State coming this weekend. But that the Big Ten basically isn't going to stack on more suspensions, and that they will be free. He'll be free to coach in the playoff and the postseason games.
Right. And the bottom line is that the Big Ten approached Michigan and shared some additional evidence that they had, I think provided by the NCAA, that made it really apparent they were going to lose in court. Their arguments that they were formulating were going to lose. And so Michigan recognized they had to concede, right? Which it just irritates me that they were going down this path. I guess I can understand that if legal counsels would have advised them to do that, but it irritates the heck out of me that they've done it, because they've never really denied that they were guilty of the rules violation. They were going to argue that everybody does it,
right?
And because everybody does it, they can't punish us unless they're going to do an investigation across everyone and open the floodgates, right? Open Pandora's box for everybody in the conference, because we're getting singled out is what they were whining about. And then the evidence made it very clear that no, you got some other issues here. We've got evidence that a booster was funding this was not typical. And so, because of that additional information, Michigan wisely backed off and had to eat crow.
Well, there you go. So now we're going to move on to some of the big games from week 12 of college football. We're only going to highlight the big ones here because we've got some more stuff to get to. But we did give a prediction on the previous podcast for Georgia-Tennessee. I predicted that Georgia would win 38-14. You predicted 45-17. And the final score ended up being 38-10 at home for Tennessee. So my score was pretty darn close. And Georgia.
And so was mine for margin.
True, true. But I got Georgia's score right on the money.
Yeah, you did.
So, yeah, Georgia once again proving why they're currently the number one team in the country. Yep. Doing really well. And we'll see if they can continue that into this upcoming weekend.
Oh, and I'm quite confident that they will. They just needed to come together. They had the talent was always there, and it's now come together.
Yes. And then the other game we predicted was Washington versus Oregon State. I predicted a pretty high scoring game, 42-31, Washington victory. And you predicted a Washington win of 35-17. It was actually even lower scoring than all that, which was 22-20. It was at home for Oregon State. And Washington actually didn't score any points at all in the second half. They had one missed field goal and then kind of sputtered offensively. So Oregon State was kind of able to come back. You know, Washington had a pretty solid lead. Oregon State made a comeback in the second half, but weren't able to close it out.
Right. Yeah, that game did not play out like I expected it would, that's for sure. Because I was higher on Washington than they performed in this particular game.
Yes. And then by far the craziest game of the whole week was Auburn versus New Mexico State. It was a home game for Auburn, and they lost 31-10. And it apparently New Mexico State went in as 25-point underdogs. They're from Conference USA, and there weren't even any turnovers in the game, so you can't like blame Auburn just having a really crap day. They just came out and massively underperformed, and now people are looking at Hugh Freeze and wondering what he's doing there over at Auburn.
Yep. Well, they are guilty of the turnstile of coaches like Nebraska. And you get into that turnstile, and they've been even more aggressive about making changes than we have. I mean, we've been, relatively speaking, patient with our underperforming coaches. They have not.
No.
So Hugh's in trouble.
Yeah. I would definitely say so. And then one of the other big upsets was UCLA versus USC. UCLA won that game 38-20 at, I believe it was home for USC as well.
It was.
And that was USC's actually last game of their regular season. So they're ending it at 7-5. So certainly a disappointment for Lincoln Riley and Caleb Williams. And we'll recall that on the last podcast, we mentioned a rumor that was going around that Chip Kelly might be fired after this weekend's game. Well, after he upsets USC, you know, their biggest rival, I don't think he's going anywhere.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I think that rumor didn't have any legs at all. So certainly they want Chip to be better, but you're not firing him after he beats USC.
No. USC did have three turnovers in that game, so that was obviously a big factor. I remember you kind of predicted it. You said that when USC lost one of their earlier games in the year that it could spiral, and they did spiral here in the second half.
They really did. And it's because they don't have, again, you want to talk about culture. That's a program that doesn't have any depth of culture, right? They are a me first culture.
Right. Well, they are a me first culture, but the king of me first culture would be, of course, Deion Sanders, Colorado, which played against Washington State this past week and got crushed 56-14.
Yeehaw. Yep. Yep. And it's funny. I don't think I sent it to you, but I sent out a series of three tweets that had occurred early in the season, you know, after they had beaten us and they were 2-0, or maybe it was after the early on in the season like that. And, you know, there were people that were comparing Deion Sanders to Nick Saban. They were comparing, they were talking about, the wide receiver slash defensive back and Sanders' son being the number one and number two candidates for the Heisman Trophy. I mean, it was just, the hype was absurd.
Yes.
And now it's all come crashing back down to earth.
Yes. Yes. So they, yeah, they're currently 4-7. They're at the bottom of the Pac-12 standings. So yeah, kind of a harsh lesson for that team. And hopefully, well, we'll see if Deion Sanders, you know, kind of changes his approach, right? The whole me first approach.
Right.
Or if he just kind of continues down that path.
And some of his coaches might very well abandon ship because some of them may get some opportunities because he brought a number of guys back from the NFL. And so those guys might decide, okay, you know, we've had our year of dealing with these kids with the NIL and all this other crap, and they're going to be like, I'm out.
Well,
it wouldn't shock me if Deion ends up with some turnover on his staff.
Well, but what do you think about the possibility of Deion taking some of these jobs that are out there, right? Because he certainly is in talks about it, and he has talent. Clearly, we saw that at the beginning of the year. But this recent downturn in success certainly hurts his chances, I think.
I would agree. I think that had he been able to continue his success, then yes, you know, a job like Texas A&M or something like that, they might have, you know, taken a serious look at Sanders. I don't think Sanders is probably a serious candidate for them unless they struck out on everyone else, which, you know, speaking of jobs and availability, are we going there? Or are we, what are we doing next here?
Well, I was going to talk about some conference championship standings.
Okay, let's do that.
Okay. One of the other big games amongst the top four teams this week was Florida State. They had to play against North Alabama, and they crushed them 58-13. Although Northern Alabama actually did go into the lead in the first quarter, and Florida State's quarterback got hurt, seriously hurt, and is out for the season. And so, you know, obviously the backup came in and played very well against this lesser opponent. But you do have to wonder, how does that affect their chances at potentially going to the playoff and trying to make the national championship?
Yeah. Well, that, you know, that committee has always indicated that, you know, key injuries absolutely factor into their decision. So if it ends up being a situation where Florida State's, you know, record and resume are close to somebody else's, say for that fourth spot, and the, you know, this quarterback being unavailable might be the tipping point that keeps them out of the playoff.
Right. So Florida State is already guaranteed to play in the ACC championship game against Louisville, and in the SEC, Georgia and Alabama already set as the contenders. So those two conferences already have their matchup set in stone. Then in some of the other conferences, we have Iowa, as we mentioned before, is guaranteed to be the Big Ten West champion, and the winner of Michigan and Ohio State this upcoming week will be in for the East Division. And then the Big 12 is kind of interesting. If Texas wins against Texas Tech, they're guaranteed to be in, but if they lose, it becomes a real mess because then there's a whole bunch of teams with like two losses in conference, and I don't know what happens.
Mm-hmm. So who's the other one in tech that would compete against Texas?
Well, it, like I said, there's like three teams that all have two losses. Like I want to say it's Oklahoma and TCU.
Oh,
and
so right. So even if Texas wins, okay, so Texas is in, but then the other side still, there's two or three teams that are in that are vying for it, I believe, depending on what happens, right?
Yes. So yeah,
so the Big 12, that's going to be a mess. Yeah.
Big 12 has some interesting situations there. Yeah, it's it's Oklahoma State, Oklahoma, and Kansas State. They all have two losses.
Yep. So, there you go.
And then in the Pac-12, Washington is guaranteed to be in. And if Oregon wins against Oregon State this weekend, then they will also be in. So gotcha. That's the current situation.
Interesting. Okay. Well, wow, a rematch of Oregon-Washington. You know, because they played each other early in the year and it was a great game. That would be a really interesting playoff implication type of game, right?
Yes, I would definitely agree. Now, we do have, obviously, the big games of Week 13 to look forward to, all the classic rivalries and stuff like that. Did you want to talk about that coaching speculation before then?
The only thing I was going to say about the coaching speculation was that there's been some commentary about Dan Lanning, the Oregon coach, being interested or being targeted by Texas A&M, which is one of the premier openings that already exist. And basically, Dan came out with a very strong statement saying, I have everything I need here. I have a lot, of unfinished business right here in Oregon. You'd be crazy to leave this situation given the resources and everything that we have here. I don't need anything. I am happy here and I'm staying. And it was very definitive. So there's no way Oregon's coach is leaving for A&M. And it doesn't matter that they drive up and dump a truckload of money on him. I think he's going to look at it and say, listen, money is not what my driving factor is. It's all this other stuff. And I'm fine. Thanks, but no thanks.
Right. I mean, because just in terms of prestige, you know, I'd say Oregon is a bit higher than Texas A&M in terms of recent success, you know, and all
Absolutely.
That. Absolutely. So, yeah.
I totally agree.
You're going to have to really do something big to convince him to leave Oregon, I think.
Well, right. And if you're wanting, I mean, you fired a coach at A&M that was going bowling this year. Yes, he had greatly underperformed, but he continued to bring enormous talent into your program. So maybe you work with him and try to figure out how you can right the ship on the aspects of the program that were underperforming, but you don't blow up the ship. And A&M, like they usually do, chose to blow up the ship.
Yes, they got out the cannons. So for week 13, obviously the big marquee game is Ohio State versus Michigan. It is at home for Michigan this year. They're coming off a tough game against Maryland, ironically the team that Nebraska nearly beat 2 weeks ago, which Michigan did win 31-24. On the other hand, Ohio State is coming off a dominant win over Minnesota, 37-3. Apparently the bookies have it as a 3.5 score favorite for Michigan, which, to your point from earlier, three of those points could be attributed to it being a home game for Michigan, right? So basically they think it's a dead even game.
Right.
And yep. We know that Jim Harbaugh won't be on the sidelines. And you talked previously about how, you know, the head coach, it wasn't that influential on game day, right? It's really in the preparation before game day. But I would say the exception to that is in really close games, right? The head coach being there on the sideline to give a really good halftime speech or whatever, that could be a deciding factor. So this is the game where it hurts to have him not there, I think.
I would agree that, yeah, this is anytime you're in a big, huge, you know, heated rivalry like this, that then that head coach's role probably becomes more significant because there's likely to be more of those pressure-packed, critical decisions that have to be made. And but again, you know, that they've got a mature team. They've been down this road before, so you know you'd think that they, as a staff, are going to be quite well prepared. I think the interesting thing for the Ohio State-Michigan matchup is that Ohio State, you know, if they were to win this game, they're already ranked ahead of Michigan in the rankings, right? The college football playoff rankings.
Right.
Like Michigan was like third. So if Michigan loses, they're on the outside looking in many respects, right? So whereas if Ohio State loses, they might still be hanging around. And depending on what happens in the conference championship games, they might sneak their way back into that top four.
Maybe. It all depends on what happens in the other conferences.
Yeah, exactly. They're at least within striking distance, where I think Michigan, they got to win this game or their lack of strength of schedule is going to hurt them. And basically, they're going to be on the outside looking in.
Right. Well, and I know that the playoff committee people said that, you know, we're not taking into account, you know, all these accusations of the sign stealing and stuff, you know,
right.
We're going to let the bodies at hand, you know, deal with the rule breaking and everything.
Yep.
But I find it hard to believe that there's not, you know, some influence on the human emotions of these judges, in that if Michigan did lose to Ohio State and was a one loss team and they're trying to argue their case, you know, you might be, if it's, you know, a tough call between Michigan, say, and Alabama or whatever, you know, you maybe give the edge to Bama because you're like, well, Michigan is, you know, in the doghouse this year, so we're not going to give you the tiebreaker, right. You know?
Right. Exactly. No, I think you're right. I mean, they wouldn't officially say that, but when it gets tight, then they might.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to give my prediction here. And just based off of recent performance, you know, Michigan has won their past two games, but they have not been dominant by any means. And Ohio State is coming into this, you know, no doubt having some beef about the whole sign stealing thing, and B, you know, very upset with the way Michigan trounced them last year. I think that Ryan Day will have his team focused and ready to play. And even though it is at the Big House, which is an advantage for Michigan, I think Ohio State will manage to win in a close shootout.
Interesting.
Maybe not. Shootout might not be the right word, but, you know, a good, pretty high scoring game. So I'll say that they win.
Right. Right.
35-28 over Michigan.
That's a good score, and that's a good prediction, Alex. You know, and just as a quick follow-up to, you know, your comment about the Michigan-Maryland game from last week, keep in mind that Michigan got a gift 7-yard return,
right.
Fumble six. Return, so yeah, from the defense that was like a cheap, easy score. And it looked like it was just going to be a walk in the park for Michigan. So the fact that Michigan kind of bogged down was highly unexpected, if you ask me. I'm shaken by that result, right? Because of the fact that I believe Nebraska should have beaten Maryland the previous week. I really believe we should have won that game.
Makes you feel a little better about how Maryland, you know, slowed down our offense, and that they slowed down Michigan's offense considerably. They also, their yep. defense also scored two safeties. So that means basically 11 points of that 31 points was scored by the defense, not the offense.
Right, right. Which, and JJ did not have a good game, their quarterback at Michigan. So they're not going into this game, you know, supremely confident and, you know, feeling like they're hitting on all cylinders. And whereas Ohio State, you know, has looked a little more intent, you know, intentional, I guess is the term, you know, these last couple of weeks. But I'm going to stay with Michigan because I feel like Ohio State still has some fundamental defensive issues that get exposed. And Michigan's offensive line is just so good and will be so focused and fired up for this game. So I'm going to predict a Michigan victory, but it is going to be a little bit high scoring, but maybe you said 35-28. I'm gonna say it's gonna be 31-21 Michigan.
Very good. The other kind of big matchup in terms of rankings and everything is the rivalry, in-state rivalry between Oregon and Oregon State. It is at home for Oregon, and Oregon State is coming off of that loss to Washington, so they'll be dropping down in ranking a bit. But as we mentioned, it was a 22-20 game. They played Washington very close. The Washington team that narrowly beat Oregon, right? So if you go by transitive property there, you would say they should do pretty well against Oregon. Now, it was at home for Oregon State, that previous game against Washington, whereas this is at home for Oregon. But of course, it's in-state, so, you know, there'll still be plenty of state fans traveling. And for Oregon State, this is the best season they've had in a long time. So, you know, they're going to be pumped up and ready for this rivalry match. I'm inclined to think that Oregon will still win, but I think it'll be a close one. What about you?
I think it'll be a blowout. I think Oregon's going to win, and it's going to be, well, blowout maybe is an overstatement, but I think Oregon's going to win, and I think it's going to be, you know, like by three scores. It's going to be 17 points or more. I'm going to say, but it'll probably be fairly high scoring. So like, I don't know, 42 to 24.
Okay. Interesting.
Oregon.
Right. Well, and I will say, yeah, if Oregon State is going to win, I think they have to keep it lower scoring because Oregon wins in a shootout. So I'm going to say that their defense steps up like they did against Washington and makes it a close game. So I'm going to say that Oregon wins, let's say, 28 to 21 over Oregon State.
Okay.
And then in terms of other games, you know, there are the obvious ones, you know, that always come around, like Florida State, Florida, Alabama, Auburn, Washington versus Washington State, Texas Tech, you know, things like that.
Now, Florida State, Florida. Now, that's an interesting one, given the injury to the Florida State quarterback.
Right. And it is at home for Florida.
You know, Florida has underperformed this year, right? Like they've been disappointing, I think, in some regards. So,
yeah,
you know, you would expect Florida State to win that football game.
Yes. Florida is coming off of a close loss to Missouri, who was ranked 9th. So they played them close, but they lost 33-31. So like you say, that I guess the big question mark would be that backup quarterback, right, for Florida State. You know, he did well against Northern Alabama, but how does he do against a much more talented Florida team, right? I think it'll be a good test for him. If he can overcome that, then you feel better about their chances going up against Louisville in the championship
game. In the conference champion game. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Interesting.
Yeah. But I was going to say that, you know, a lot of the other ones, you know, at least on paper, seem one-sided, right? Like Alabama, Auburn, after Auburn just got beat by New Mexico State, right? You can't feel too good about their chances, even though it is a home game for Auburn. You know, the Iron Bowl has had crazy results in the past, but I don't think I can give it to them.
I agree.
Yeah.
And Texas Tech, kind of the same thing. Although Texas Tech has had some big victories. You know, Texas Tech beat Kansas, and that kind of was a big victory for Texas Tech and a huge disappointment for KU. So Texas Tech has capability, you know, it's not like they're a pushover.
Yep.
But Texas is the superior team if they both play well.
Yes. And LSU is playing at home against Texas A&M, right, who is obviously dealing with the loss of their head coach. And LSU is kind of on the warpath right now with their quarterback, Jaden Daniels, making his push for the Heisman. So I'll be curious to see if they try to go super aggressive in that one.
Right. Interesting. Yeah, I think they probably will. But if A&M isn't up to the task, LSU will put pedal to the metal, turn up the gas, whatever you want to say, and they'll crush them if they can.
Yeah, very true. All right. Well, this has been an exciting podcast. It's kind of sad that we're already near the end of college football season. Doesn't feel too long ago that we started up in the fall.
I know. So much optimism.
Only to be crushed by brutal reality. Yes. We're going to go bowling. That's our prediction here. So
That's right. That's what we're predicting and hoping for.
Yes.
And then good things happen next year.
Right. So yes, next week's podcast will be specifically focused on what those conference championship games are. We will obviously know by next week. We'll be talking more about the playoff rankings, you know, the implications, right? Giving our predictions for who we think the top four will be. And hopefully we'll be celebrating Nebraska's win over Iowa, but we'll see. And the girls' win in volleyball over Wisconsin. That would be a great double whammy, wouldn't it? All on a Friday.
Oh my gosh. That would be crazy. Yep.
So we'll see is dad going into the weekend a tipsy happy man or the opposite.
a miserable, grumpy old man.
Yes, so we'll find out, listeners. But
exactly,
we hope you all have a good Thanksgiving. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can reach out to us at huskerpete13@gmail.com. You can also search for us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. If you search for College Football Throwdown, you can leave us a rating or review there, or a comment. We can read them out on the air. We love hearing from the fans. So thank you all for listening, and thank you for listening to us for this episode. And until next time, go Big Red.
Go Big Red.